This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Northern Kentucky University political scientist Michael Baranowski. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, attorney and former deputy assistant to President Trump, Mae Mailman.
Hey, Mike, it's good to be back.
Yeah, I've missed our discussions over things, and I am very much looking forward to getting into what was, as usual, I guess, another busy and interesting week in the world of American politics. So, but before we jump into that, I do want to make sure I thank some new supporters, including Stephen, a longtime listener who recently sent us a support donation through PayPal. Yes, that's a thing you can do. Also, Jan, a new supporter on Patreon, and Abhishek, who's been a supporter for a number of years now on Patreon, who moved from monthly to yearly support, which you can do and save 10%. So there you go. And thank you very much, guys. We really do appreciate it. And one more thing before we get going with our first story is I wanted to pass along a few quick podcast recommendations. The first being our fellow Democracy Group show, Future Hindsight. They're an award-winning show. They take big ideas about civic life, about democracy, and they turn them into, I guess you call them, action items for all of us. And in recent episodes, they've talked about fixing immigration, the $500 million guns in the United States. That's a lot of guns. Simplifying government to make it more efficient, more responsive, the intentions of the founders. There's just a ton of great stuff. Totally check it out. And I, of course, I'll mention my other podcast, Sustainable Planet. In the latest episode, Kimberly and I, we get into carbon footprints, climate shadows, supposedly environmentally conscious celebrities and their private jets. My home thermostat battle with Kimberly, I think, gets in there. She won that one. Anyway, a lot of stuff. I hope you'll check that out as well. And you can find Sustainable Planet as well as Future Hindsight wherever you get your podcasts. And we will also put links to each of them in today's show notes. All right. So with that, Mae, why don't you kick things off for us today with we can talk a little bit about student protests.
Yeah. So this is, you know, across the country, from UCLA and Stanford to Columbia, the epicenter, I guess, used to be Yale, MIT, University of Michigan, notably not at the University of Florida. There have been, at this point, more than 2,000 arrests. And I think, yeah, sort of horrifying stories coming out of these protests. At UCLA, you saw someone stomping on a Jewish girl's head, requiring her to go to the emergency room. People are forbidding Jewish students from entering various parts of campus. And then there's just been some ridiculousness, like demands that the university provide the people who are taking over, violently taking over buildings, provide them with vegan food, and at the University of Chicago, provide them with Plan B and various contraceptives for their tent pleasure. So, you know, not the best look for America, but I guess I have a couple of reactions. The first is, this is happening at college campuses and not community colleges. And I think there's a reason why, a couple of reasons. First is that people who go to community colleges have their own problems to deal with. They are trying to juggle work and school. They're trying to juggle families. They don't have the luxury of thinking that protest is some sort of job or responsibility for them. They have other things going on. There is a huge privilege associated with taking finals time, taking your parents' money, taking the government's money, and using it to squat on a college campus. And I think part of that is there's been a fetishizing of oppression. And so here you've got a bunch of wealthy kids, smart kids whose lives have been good. And yet we've been told that the best good, the highest good, is oppression, including by these colleges, where the admissions essays to get in is basically explain to me how you're oppressed, right? Like your personal stories, the things that you've overcome. So oppression is the number one good, and they are not oppressed. And so they are fantasizing oppression. And you can see that in their demands for vegan food. I demand basic humanitarian aid, that hatred of the West, hatred of themselves, I think, has become the good. And I think that that is a huge societal problem. We as a society cannot move forward, it's not a good place to be where the best thing you can be is oppressed. So that's piece one. And then I think the other reaction is should concern us about terrorism and domestic extremism popping up in our country. And this is something that the FBI has said, that the intelligence community believes that the risk of a terrorist attack inside the United States is at its highest point since 9/11. And I don't think that it takes much to take somebody who is violently beating up Jewish students, that's protesting, you know, essentially in favor of Hamas, and to convert them into a anti-Western terrorist. I think that step is pretty small, actually. And so, and the fact that there is money and there are targeted people behind some of these protests, that this shouldn't be just like, oh, these college kids are stupid and this is annoying. This should be very concerning to us for a U.S. safety perspective because of the anti-Western sentiment and because of the money behind it. So those are my two big reactions. Mike, I guess you guys already talked about this, but anything stand out to you over the past week?
Yeah, I've been trying to think about it in a number of ways, think a little more deeply about it as the protests have escalated. And I wanted to hit on the one point you mentioned, that this isn't happening at community colleges. And it's, in fact, it's not happening at, by my calculation, 98.5% of U.S. colleges. So, but I think you're right that if we take a look at the places where it is happening the most and the most fiercely, it is that it does seem like there's, at least my initial reaction was, entitled rich kids. Oh my God. And that's, Jay always used to joke that I'm sort of a reverse snob. And I guess I am, because if you say Ivy League to me or Harvard to me, my initial response is to just kind of push back from that sort of thing. And I think a lot of Americans feel that way, which is why I think that whole idea of negative polarization means in the end that these students are probably in the end, or other people, hurting their cause, because it's not a very sympathetic look. But on the other hand, I want to get to that point you mentioned about, well, they have the time to protest, they have the privilege to protest. And I think there's something, you know, true to that as well. There's this idea of what's called post-materialist values. And it's a theory that was developed, I think, in the 70s by a guy named Ron Engelhardt, a political scientist. And this idea that, well, once you have kind of basic things taken care of, like you're economically secure and you have that sense of material security, you can look toward other values, what you might consider higher values, even if somebody else doesn't, like the oppression of people in Gaza. And to me, there's no question that people in Gaza are oppressed. We can talk about, you know, argue about reasons why, but it's a horrible place to live for a lot of reasons. And so I guess in part, I like the fact that we have people in this country who do have the freedom to protest and are able to protest. And I agree with President Biden that there is a long and storied American tradition of peaceful protest. I'd even go further. I'd say there's a proud tradition of civil disobedience. But where I draw the line, and I'm sure where you agree with me on this, is that when that moves from peaceful protest to civil disobedience into violent protest, then that's not okay, which is why I've been pretty much in line with the responses that a lot of these campuses have taken.
Yeah, it reminds me of the studies of rat utopias where they gave the rats everything they needed, enough food, enough space, and the rats stopped reproducing and they just like sat around. Like once you had everything you wanted, you stopped working for things that you need to survive. And I feel like we are a wealthy country and we have everything we need, and especially some of these people. And now what are we working toward? We're working toward the seeming destruction of America, American values. I'm interested also in your take. So at the University of Alabama, there was a moment where the protesters and the counter protesters came together in a F Joe Biden chant. It was a fleeting moment of agreement, but it was a moment of agreement. And I'm wondering if you're concerned about what we're going to see at the DNC in Chicago, where these pro-Hamas groups have already demanded that there be space to protest. They have not been given that space. They've sued the city, but you know, we know they're going to be there.
Yeah. I mean, the whole Genocide Joe thing is just kind of blows my mind. And yeah, I think there's a reasonable chance that something like that will happen to mar the Democratic National Convention later on this summer. And of course, it's a concern. And like you said, there are security concerns as well. So I guess I find myself torn here because I when we talk about especially outside agitators, that's a phrase that also kind of makes me feel like we're at some kind of 50s anti-communism sort of thing. And I want to talk about that term a little bit because, well, outside agitators are involved. And I wonder, just because all the people at Columbia aren't Columbia students or these other schools, I don't think that invalidates the protest in any way. It doesn't surprise me that there are professional organizers who are trying to ramp up or escalate things. And as far as I'm concerned, so long as it doesn't cross the line into violence and kind of illegal intimidation, I'm okay with that. But in many cases, of course, it has crossed that line and I'm not okay with that. But I don't have a problem with outside agitators per se. And it just seems to me it's just a way of kind of othering the whole thing, saying, well, these people who don't share our values and all that. I don't know that that's necessarily the case. They're very strongly committed to this, I guess you could say either pro-Palestine or anti-Israel. And maybe that's, might want to talk about that a little bit, because I think it's one thing to be pro-Palestine and an anti-Israeli government, but I have a problem when it becomes, well, you know, Jews go back to wherever. That just, I think a whole kind of red lights flash for me when I hear that kind of thing.
Yeah. So it's weird because at first I was very irritated to refocus on the professional organizers, because it almost seemed to minimize the role of the students and my concern that these universities are hotbeds of anti-Semitism and anti-Westernism and just the sort of, I don't know, the problem of having an entire educated youth cohort that like these are their values. So I didn't like focusing on the outside agitators. You know, now I sort of think it's important because if there are well-funded, well-organized groups who love to take things like George Floyd's death, like a war in the Middle East, and create rampant nationwide angst, right? Property destruction, assault and battery, just division, like, which is, I think, maybe worse than those two other things, then I think that that's like, we have to go figure out what to do about that problem, because it is a huge problem. It's one that we have to deal with as a country that respects freedom of speech, but it's not one we have to necessarily live with and support. So I do think that there's something worth focusing on there. But yeah, I guess to your point of, should having professional agitators take away from the merits of the cause, like whatever the, you know, obviously war is bad, and let's not forget that war is bad. I just don't know what these college students are actually protesting for. I really think that if they cared about indiscriminate killing or whatever, then they should care about what Hamas does to their own people. They should listen to Secretary Blinken when he says a ceasefire has been offered by Israel and it will not be accepted by Hamas because they will not hand over hostages. They will not agree. They will not agree to a ceasefire. They don't want a ceasefire. They want the destruction of Israel. And so, like, it is a stupid mess. Whatever the protests are about, there should be, their message is asinine, in my opinion. Like, they don't know anything. And so the professional organizer piece of it, I think, helps me understand what is going on in these college students' heads, because there's nothing going on. There's just actually outside groups who are committed to anti-Western values that are capitalizing on oppression fetish that these college students have. And there actually is nothing good about these college students' messages. I've seen on Instagram, oh, why are you focusing on college students when there are mass graves in Gaza? Why don't you care about the mass graves? Well, A, Israel has disputed the claim that they have anything to do with mass graves. And who am I going to believe, our democratic ally or a bunch of terrorists? And so I just, anything that has to do with, like, let's talk about the merits of what's going on in the Middle East and how bad it is, I just can't take it seriously from a bunch of college students who don't know anything and are saying queers for Palestine. Now, like, if you're saying queers for Palestine, I you have nothing going on in your brain, in my opinion.
Well, you're at school, and I you know, there's also the idea of negative polarization cuts both ways. You know, you're a college student, you're there at Columbia or what have you, and you say, oh, the cops are massing against us out in the quad. Well, we should go out there and be, you know, and support our side. And I think that becomes part of it. You know, it can be, in a way, protests can be sort of like a party-like atmosphere. There's always that, right, that core of people who are the true believers, the folks who don't mind stomping on a few heads and, in fact, maybe even want to do that. But there are so many people on the periphery of this sort of thing. I mean, it's the same sort of argument, and I think it's a fair argument. Like, if we look back to January 6th, right, there were these hardcore people who came with the zip ties and the other stuff and wanted to bust some heads. But there are a lot of people just like, I don't know, everyone's going into the Capitol. I guess, well, let's check it out sort of thing. And there's always going to be that similar dynamic in any kind of mass movement, which is why mass movements are just, in that mass protests, are invariably emotional, invariably dumb, and don't really respond to rational arguments because you can't fit that on your little placard, right? I mean, so whether it's queers for Palestine or hang Mike Pence, I mean, you do what you can to get that little bit of attention at the time. But yeah, I think that's, to me, expecting any kind of mass protest to be intelligent is by default going to be a failure, I think.
So I just have one final thought, and I think part of the responsibility or for the out of control nature of these protests, the violent nature, has to do with the weak leadership of universities, where they have given and given and given and said, okay, don't be violent, but, you know, just have your own space. And that type of response to the protests have obviously led to the assault and discrimination and harassment of Jewish students. But I think that where you see strong leadership, you have not seen that. So I loved the University of Florida gave a statement to the press about their reaction, calling the police and getting rid of, you know, violent protests. And they said, this is not complicated. The University of Florida is not a daycare, and we do not treat protesters like children. They knew the rules, they broke the rules, and they'll face the consequences. And I think that that type of reaction is so powerful, which is you can have your First Amendment, but you have to know the rules. And when you break the rules, there will be consequences. And I think if more university leaders had taken that approach, then you would actually be able to have free speech and not violence. And so I hope that university administrators are like taking note of this.
I think it. Well, I know for a fact that with a lot of university administrators, that even at the upper levels, that it can be really challenging, because the first instinct is almost never going to be to crack down on something students are doing. Even if you disagree with it, cracking down on students in any way, it just creates so many headaches and makes your life so difficult that you look for ways to not do that. And there's also this idea that universities are supposed to be places that encourage expression in ways that you wouldn't expect in almost any other institutional setting. And you bring those two things together, and I think it creates an environment that will oftentimes result in administrators holding back on these things with the results that you see. And so I think, well, Florida State had the advantage in a way of seeing what happened and seeing the mistakes that were made by other institutions. But I mean, I certainly agree with the fundamental message here is that, hey, here are the rules for protest. If you choose to obey those rules, great. If you don't, there are going to be consequences. We're going to enforce those consequences. And I think that's important to do. So I think on that point, you and I are in pretty complete agreement.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
All right. Well, why don't we move on to something that's, well, somewhat related, I would say, because this last week, there was a large bipartisan majority in the House. They passed the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, 320-91 vote. We had 21 Republicans and 70 Democrats. That's just over half of all House Democrats voting against it. Now, if this legislation ends up getting through the Senate and being signed by President Biden, it would recognize the definition of anti-Semitism that was developed by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. And it would require the Department of Education to use that definition when investigating various allegations of anti-Semitism, which could lead to withholding of federal funds for any institution that might not take sufficient appropriate action to restrict anti-Semitic activity on campus. And so now it's in the Senate, where I would say at this point, it looks like it faces somewhat longer odds due to actually opposition both from the right and the left on this issue. So, May, I was wondering, what do you think about this legislation just in general? Is it something that you feel is worth supporting, or maybe not so much?
I think it's frustrating, I guess. I don't mind supporting it. I don't actually have any free speech problems with it, because all it does is define anti-Semitism, but you still need action. You still need discrimination. You still need behavior in order for a university to be found in violation. So the people who are saying this criminalizes speech, no, it doesn't. Title VI cannot criminalize speech. Just like any amount of racism, for non-Jewish type of racism, you can't just have speech. You actually do need action. So I'm not concerned about that. like there's people saying, oh my gosh, it's criminalized, like reading the Bible because you think that the Jews killed Jesus. And it just, it's no.
Marjorie Taylor Greene, yeah, mentioned that one, yeah.
But I think the frustration that I have is you have Republicans, dear Republicans, you have been given a moment where universities have exposed themselves for not protecting students. And the reason that they're not protecting Jewish students is because of their closeness to whiteness, that there has been an oppressor versus oppressed narrative that has been pushed by elite corners of the of our society. And like universities are not being held accountable. They just keep getting government money to do what? To do what? Not to provide our nation with the engineers we need, the nurses we need. We have to have, you know, H-1B programs to get that type of skill, to instead have gender studies majors that hate America. Defund these universities, hold them accountable, and say, if you are going to run a Hamas clinic, then you're going to do it on your own dime and you're not going to do it with government money. Instead of doing that, all they did was codify something that's already the case. It is already the case that Title VI covers anti-Semitism where it is racism. So this bill does nothing, and it squanders an opportunity to actually get universities to provide the public service that I think people hoped that they would provide. So for me, that is the frustration.
I guess I'll take this on 2 minutes. For one thing, I would argue, well, I would have voted against it, just like, I don't say this often, just like Thomas Massie, who said this is a poorly conceived, unconstitutional bill, and I will vote no. Now, Thomas Massie, I think on his little voting machine, there might not even be a yes button. But in any case, Thomas Massie, Marjorie Taylor Greene, I'm with them on this, weirdly. But I'm also with Jerry Nadler, who calls himself a deeply committed Zionist who voted against it. I do have some free speech issues with it, not with the definition. The definition seems pretty straightforward, you know, anti-Semitism, a certain perception of Jews, which may be expressed as hatred toward Jews. Yeah, I'm absolutely against that. But in the legislation, it says we're not only going to codify the definition, but we're going to codify the examples as things that we would consider anti-Semitism. Like, for instance, one of those examples, accusing Jewish citizens of being more loyal to Israel or to the interest of their own nations, or claiming the existence of the state of Israel is a racist endeavor, or drawing comparisons of contemporary Israeli policy to that of the Nazis. Now, I don't agree with any of those statements, if someone's arguing those as being true, but I certainly have a big problem with saying that making that argument, as wrongheaded as it might be, is anti-Semitism and therefore should potentially even trigger withholding federal funds from institutions. So I have a big free speech issue with it. I don't think it would stand up to First Amendment scrutiny in any case. But I would also argue that, you know, the problem with withholding funds, that's a tricky thing because, of course, the vast majority of students are not doing anti-Semitic things, the vast, vast majority, and they're just kind of going about their lives with their heads down in school with their federal student loans. And so I don't even know that I feel like oftentimes that a small minority, a very small minority of people who are doing some reprehensible things are being elevated in a way to say, well, look, our college campuses are anti-Semitic. And I would say, well, there's certainly some anti-Semitism that we can see on these campuses. But to go further and say we are training a class of anti-Semitic elites in these colleges, that I don't think the evidence is there to say that as kind of a blanket statement, because I don't really think it comports with reality.
So one of the reasons I am surprised, I guess, so I worked on the executive order during the Trump administration issued in December 2019. It's called the Executive Order on Combating Anti-Semitism. And, you know, my memory is like, it's hard to remember every single executive sure. order I worked on. I do remember this one for a couple of reasons. One, is it okay to call Jews a race? Like, are we at that point where we can say Jewish people are a race. That's what Hitler said. Is that good to issue an executive order? So that was a big discussion. And then, but you know, like if that's what like the Jewish community wants, then I guess that's different than Hitler. So, okay. Then the second was what you said, like, let's look at these examples and they're totally, this is, I think, prior to October 7th, when people were saying Elon Musk is anti-Semitic because, or maybe it was even after it, but because he tweeted something that was just, in my opinion, totally fine. And so I've always thought that there's been this quick jump to call anything anti-Semitic. And I don't like that. And so what, and we were concerned about that. And so if you look at the Trump executive order, it says that the examples of anti-Semitism are relevant to the extent that any examples might be useful as evidence of discriminatory intent. So it's not saying if you do one of the examples, therefore you're, it's a Title VI violation, which forbids discrimination on the basis of race. But it's just saying it's okay to consider these things. And I don't necessarily read the bill to be doing anything different, which is that it says the Department of Education shall take into consideration the definition of anti-Semitism in assessing whether that a practice, therefore a behavior, conduct, was motivated by anti-Semitic intent. So it is not actually criminalizing the speech. You actually do have to have a behavior, conduct, something that is racist. And then in painting the picture of whether that thing, drawing a swastika on someone's dorm room, whatever, all the things that you're going to think about whether this is motivated by racism, you can take into consideration that definition. And guess what? People are already doing that. Since 2018, the Department of Education has already out loud been doing that. So that's why I think it actually doesn't change anything. I'm not concerned about its criminalizing of speech. I just think it's stupid.
Well, and I think it was legislation that was designed more to be messaging legislation than to actually pass. Because if they just would have removed Section 4, Subsection 2, which says it, this definition includes the contemporary examples of anti-Semitism identified in the IHRA definition, then almost all of the free speech issues that both people on the left and on the right brought up, that they would largely go away. But again, I think this was just designed more as a message. I would actually be surprised if it came to a vote in the Senate, but it certainly can be a cudgel, right, to beat people with it. Why didn't you vote against anti-Semitism? You must be an anti-Semite.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, like, any list of examples is always going to be over-inclusive and under-inclusive, right? There are going to be things that are anti-Semitism that are not listed. There are going to be things that you can do here that in context are totally fine, like believing in the Bible, for example. But, you know, having something somewhere that actually anti-Semitism is tough because there's, I think people have a general understanding of what racism, anti-Black racism is, maybe because it's close to home, history in our country, or you know somebody who's racist, like you have that understanding. Versus, I think, especially for people who grew up in the Midwest or without any, like, without any contact with Judaism, except to know that, like, Jesus was Jewish, you don't really know. And so, while I don't love having all these examples because I don't agree that all of them necessarily equal anti-Semitism, on the other hand, isn't it good to somewhere have some sort of basis to know, okay, this is something that Jewish people receive as hateful? And you can agree or disagree whether people should, but there is a training component. Maybe it's bad for the federal government to be participating in that training component, but I think people sometimes just don't know.
No, I think that's fair because I certainly, the one example I pointed out, right, accusing Jewish people of being more loyal to Israel than to the country. That's a common anti-Semitic trope, but it also, in some instances, is factually the case. We know of American citizens who have spied on the United States for Israel. And so that would be an example of, well, if you accuse that person of being more loyal to Israel than to their own country, well, you would be, you know, factually correct. So it can't be anti-Semitic in that sense if it's just, you see what I'm saying, obviously.
Exactly, right. So, you know, and one of the things that's an example potentially of anti-Semitism is denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, for example, by claiming that the existence of the state of Israel is a racist endeavor. So it's like, on one hand, you know, I think that it could be anti-Semitic to get in a Jewish student's face, assault them, and say, "For the river to the sea," and like call for the destruction of Israel. On the other hand, just having like a Middle East policy discussion and say that, you know, in your opinion, like Israel should not have been created and this is a better, you know, place for it. Like having that discussion, even though you disagree with it, should be fine. It depends on the context.
Yeah.
And I think that, that Title VI does take into consideration that context, that behavior, and yeah. So maybe the examples are just like more harmful than helpful.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, people are going to refer to these types of things anyway. Like, these were in people's heads anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a great point about the example sometimes being more harmful than helpful, because people want oftentimes sort of bright line definitions, but in many instances, as you pointed out, it can be very dependent on even something like tone of voice, right? And so trying to codify everything, this is anti-Semitism, this is racism, this isn't, that I think almost invariably is going to fail at some point and maybe even be more harmful than helpful. All right. Well, why don't we move on to something that has nothing to do, I don't think, with Gaza or Israel or anti-Semitism.
Yeah. So the Biden administration this past week announced that they are going to reclassify marijuana from a Schedule 1 classified substance to a Schedule 3. Which is not to say that that's an announcement that marijuana will now be like Advil. It will more be like ketamine. So it still has to be FDA approved. It will not be freely accessible. And therefore, a lot of the states that make marijuana much more like Advil and available to people 21 and up for any reason, those states are not going to be in compliance with federal law still. But it is a great messaging moment, according to the Biden administration, that they can show that they're hip, they're young, they're cool, they like marijuana, which, you know, the vast majority of Americans at this point do believe that marijuana should not be a Schedule 1 classified drug, that there should at least be access for medicinal use, which I sort of am not sure whether there is any such medicinal use for marijuana. And so this like marijuana pandering is not new from the Biden administration. Last year, they made an announcement at 4:20 p.m. that they were considering this move. On April 20th of this year, Biden and Harris tweeted at 4:20 that they supported reducing criminal penalties for pot users. So this is part of their political strategy to go to get young people more excited about the Biden ticket, because young people are not, they're certainly not like pro-Trump necessarily, but they're not excited. They're not excited about Biden, and it's not looking like he's going to have the same support in a very close race. So total political move. I actually don't think that any of this is going to be, nothing is actually going to be put in place by the time the election rolls around, because this is still an announcement. You still need there to actually be a rule proposed. The regulatory mechanism is still very much at ground level. And then, like I said, even after the regulation goes through, assuming it does go through, it still doesn't put the states fully in compliance. And yet federal prosecutors have not been going after marijuana incidents. So nothing is actually going to change. It's still going to be state by state, and the states are still going to be out of legal compliance. But now the Biden administration can at least say out loud that they're in favor of Schedule 3 classification. So I don't know, Mike, are the young people going to vote for Biden now?
Well, if you're counting on the stoner vote to save you, you've got some problems. But putting the politics aside for a minute, I'll say that just as a matter of the matter of fact, Schedule 1 is an incorrect place to put marijuana. Now, Schedule 1 is limited to drugs that have no currently accepted medical use. Now, by definition, that isn't marijuana, because there is an FDA-approved cannabis drug used to treat seizures. So there's at least one example, and there's plenty of studies and evidence that suggest, and people may disagree, and they should, I think, if the evidence points that way, that there are plenty of potential medicinal uses for marijuana. So it's incorrect, I would argue, as a matter of fact, to have it at Schedule 1 there. Now, I would also argue that if you are anti-pot, if you are one of those people who say, you know, I think it's been overhyped, and there are serious dangers, and that people shouldn't be taking it, I think you might have a point. But one of the problems with this has been there's very little good research. And part of that is because marijuana is Scheduled 1. If you want to do research with marijuana, you have to apply in a very rigorous sort of way, because it's the Schedule 1 drug. You have to get your pot from this. Now, it used to be only one place, I believe, in Louisiana. And a lot of the folks who got the pot from there said it was this kind of moldy skunk weed kind of stuff that bore little resemblance to the sort of pot that normal people get. All kinds of regulatory burdens. And as a result, there's not nearly enough research to tell us about what could very well be some significant developmental and other kind of dangers for marijuana. So I would say that if you're anti-pot, you should like this, because this is going to mean there's going to be more research, and maybe that research will bear it out that, yeah, pot's this dangerous drug and should be, you know, we should take that into account. And so I think that would be a good thing. Now, as to the politics, yeah, of course, there's at least a tiny political benefit for the Biden administration. And so I don't think it's going to matter a whole lot. I don't see the kids, you know, or I don't see people saying, well, you know, this is the one thing I needed to get out to the polls. But maybe it matters a little bit at the margins. But on the whole, this is something that makes research easier, and that's going to give us more information about a drug that a lot of people use. I think that's only a good thing.
So, as you referenced, one of the prior issues with reclassifying is, or, you know, I guess controversy surrounding, is Schedule 1 drugs have very tight research restrictions. You can't just, you know, not everyone can just take a bunch of cocaine and give it to people and say, how's it affecting your brain? Like, it, for sort of obvious reasons, the U.S. government very tightly controls who has access to these types of drugs and controls the research top to bottom, applying for licenses, applying for access, that type of thing. And so there's this sort of basic understanding that the pot these days is not your grandmother's pot. It is stronger. It's different. And so if you want to understand how pot affects the brain, etc., you need research, and you need research, rampant research, and you need it on a bunch of different types of varieties today's. And so that is a net good, people think. But the problem is, so when you reclassify to be less stringent, then you have less restrictions on research. So one of the problems facing that reclassification is that the United States signed a treaty about controlled substances, which makes sense to have an international agreement about controlled substances, because if one country is rampant research and no controls and here's all the drugs you want, and another country isn't, like in our global marketplace, then there essentially are no restrictions. And so having like-minded countries come together and generally have the same controls is a good idea. And so the problem is that marijuana is part of this tightly controlled understanding within the treaty. And so it was the United States' understanding that they couldn't reclassify, they couldn't have loose restrictions on research consistent with treaty obligations. And on one hand, I think that that understanding is correct, even though it is frustrating. And so I will be interested to see what the Biden administration's interpretation of their treaty obligations are, or whether they just don't care. And that has been some of the reason why this has been such a slow moving process. And so there could be just something like totally unlawful about reclassifying, in that unless you go back and you reconstitute the treaty, which I haven't seen, you are out of obligation with treaty obligations. Maybe nobody cares, but I thought, you know,
sure,
maybe you should care. So that is some of the background. But why should international obligations prevent the Biden administration from going after the stoner vote? So, you know, we've all got our priorities.
It sounds like one spot where we agree is that, given the ubiquity of marijuana in so many Americans' lives, it sure would be good if we knew a little bit more, if we knew a lot more about how it affects people, especially, I would say, with long-term and sort of regular use. And we don't know enough. I don't feel that we know enough about that. And I expect you would agree with that, right?
I do agree because, I think Americans, you know, have a comfort level with pot because of its ubiquity. And so I think there's this desire that people who deal pot, you know, shouldn't be sent away for life. Like there does feel like, you know, pot is okay-ish. But on the other hand, I think we've all seen what's happened to the, you know, homeless population in Denver, where it just seems like you've got a lot of young people who could be working, who could be doing something. And instead, they're like harassing tourists in tents in the middle of a city. And so, you know, is there something that it changes with your brain? What does it do? What about pregnancy? Like, which, of course, there's no research about anything in pregnancy.
Yeah,
but there are some women who believe that taking pot is like good for them during pregnancy. I have to say that that's probably not the case.
Yeah.
And that really, like, that's concerning to me, because all of a sudden now you are harming someone else. And so I do agree there needs to be research to try and figure out where that line should be of maybe we can relax in some way. But I don't see the benefit of weed. And so if we can get the research to like back my situation up, I'm all for that.
And you know, there are some advocates who say we need to do more than drop it down to Schedule 3. We need to remove it from the system and treat it more like alcohol and tobacco. Now, in one sense, I get their argument, because you can make what I think is a non-trivial argument that, well, the health consequences of tobacco, the health consequences of alcohol, when weighed against the almost zero benefits, seem to suggest that if, say, tobacco or alcohol were new drugs, were new things that were developed, there's no way that they would be legalized. And so I think, you know, the pot advocates are saying, well, wait a second, if we have these two destructive drugs that have almost no upside and pot's less so, then why can't pot be in the same circumstance? And I think there's an argument there, but of course, in a sense, that doesn't matter because that's just the way life is. Life is unfair. We're not going to reclassify, you know, or make tobacco or make alcohol illegal because it's just too much ingrained in our society. Maybe tobacco at some point, but certainly not alcohol. My God, you'd have a revolution on your hands. So I'm wondering what you think about the folks who point to that kind of argument.
Yeah, I just think it's, as you say, kind of a historical fact, which is from the founding of our country, like, people have had a beer, you know, and so you can't recreate our entire society to say, well, you know, pot is better than alcohol, so alcohol should, and pot should be treated the same. Like, just in the fiber of our country, they're not the same. So I just, yeah, it's hard for me to treat things the same that just historically are not.
And I think the other thing is, to me, the argument, well, these dangerous drugs aren't scheduled, so therefore we should have this drug, which may be dangerous but isn't as dangerous, not be scheduled. That's sort of a it's elevating consistency ahead of public safety, of public health, and that's never an argument that I don't think that's a very good logical argument.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't necessarily know where marijuana should be scheduled or if it should be scheduled, and just rely on the, you know, American public making the right decision. But I do know, I think, that this decision and, you know, pot decisions generally tend to be political and not scientific. And I have concerns about that. And if we're making our public health decisions based on politics rather than policy and legal obligations, that seems unsafe.
Absolutely. I certainly agree with that, which is why I am eager for more research to get a better scientific sense of dangers and potential benefits and that sort of thing. But the other point I wanted to make is one you made earlier on, is that this doesn't change the legal status of marijuana. It's still illegal under federal law. It's not like federal prosecutors are going to go out and start, you know, they've kind of had a hands-off sort of view toward this. In fact, it's still really difficult for people who are even in states where marijuana is legal, even recreationally, about half the states now at this point, because of things like access to the banking system, right? There's this legislation that's been in Congress for a while now, the Safer Banking Act, which would basically give these financial institutions, which are saying, I don't want to deal with pot businesses because it's a violation of federal law, we get into trouble. It would basically provide them with sort of a safe harbor sort of thing, though that's a more, I would argue, a more substantive thing that hasn't advanced as far as I would like to see it advance, because I sort of feel for these businesses who are in these states. It's like, well, it's legal for us to do this, but we have to arrange things, especially small businesses, in such a way where we don't have access to credit, we don't have access to basic banking services that any other business would, or that these big, you know, mega whatever pot businesses might. I have a problem with that, the kind of level of playing field. I'd like to see that sort of thing end up going through Congress, but I would expect you're a little more hesitant about that than I would be.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it is dangerous to have things like all cash businesses for marijuana because there's not access to
exactly
banking. And to the extent that marijuana, so it's bad to have marijuana live in a quasi-legal status, I think. It just creates a lot of weird incentives. It creates a lot of weird business practices. And so I do think there should be clarity. What is it like? Is it like alcohol? Is it like cocaine? What's it like? But then treat it like that. And so part of the issue is there is this, okay, legally it is cocaine, but in practice we're treating it like alcohol. And so if we could actually come together and actually treat it actually like a Schedule 3, treat it like ketamine, where it does have to be approved by the FDA, where states can't just bypass FDA approval, where you can't just deal unlicensed ketamine, like that they're that we're actually then going to enforce it. I think that makes the most sense. So, but that doesn't seem to actually be what they're going to do. They're just going to reschedule it as Schedule 3. And then they're going to keep treating it sort of like alcohol, and it's still going to live in this quasi-legal status. So,
and the big problem with that is there's this huge illegal market. In fact, in a lot of states, because even in states where pot is recreationally legal, it still is oftentimes cheaper and more convenient for people to buy their pot through illegal means than through legal dispensaries and so forth. And so that's, again, because of this weird status of marijuana. It's not alcohol, it's not tobacco. And so we have this thriving, very large illegal industry, even in place where it is legally available, which is a weird situation and not a good one. All right. Well, on that, we will close. But before we go, if you disagree with us on marijuana, on anti-Semitism awareness, on any of the things we talked about, we want to hear from you. You can reach us in a lot of ways. There's good old-fashioned email, mail@politicsguys.com. There's Facebook and X. We always have links in the show notes. Also, our Discord discussion forum, which we have there for supporters. Love to hear from you about what you think, what you love, what you hated, all that kind of stuff. And if you're not a supporter, we hope you'll consider becoming one. You get all kinds of stuff that we hope you'll like ad-free versions of everything we release, the full-length midweek episode as opposed to those just like 15-minute preview snippet sort of things. You get to be on that Discord group, which is a lot of fun, and all that stuff. Check it out. Go to politicsguys.com/support or patreon.com/politicsguys. If you don't want to remember links, who does? Just check out the links in the show notes there. And if you would like to get that full-length midweek episode I mentioned, but you're not in a position to financially support us right now, totally not a problem. Send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get that set up for you right away. And whether you support us or not through Patreon, PayPal, Venmo, what have you, large cash donations in brown paper bags, we'll take those too. We would appreciate it if you could just subscribe to the podcast, rate us, review us on whatever podcast app you happen to be using. And as always, before we go, I want to say a special thanks to our executive producers. They're a wonderful bunch. Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope you'll join us.
This podcast is part of the Democracy Group,